Welcome, everybody. I'd like to call the House Subcommittee to Higher Education to order. This is Thursday, March 17th, a little after 1 p.m. on St. Patrick's Day. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3356, and we have a couple other hearings to follow that, but we'll go ahead and start this bill first. We have some esteemed members of our legislature with us today. They're going to talk about that. So with that, I'll open up a hearing on House Bill 3356 and call Representative Nolan and Senator Winters.
Thank you.
And I apologize for our colleagues not being timely. I'm sure they'll come in, so I hope that's not a distraction.
I'm sure they will. I think we were, you know, this building is on rapid.
Yes.
Sometimes I think we need skates going across those marble halls, but anyway, I'm sure they'll be here. For the record, I'm State Senator Jackie Winters from District 10. And just to give some context, House Bill 3356, it prohibits community colleges or institutions of higher education from placing academic hold on student registration if students is within 6 credits of graduating and students agree, and I'm going to emphasize that, and students agree to a payment plan. You know, you may note that an amendment is being drafted to change the standard from 6 credits to 8. Undergraduate student credits hours are allocated in 4-credit increments. This amendment will allow an undergraduate student who is within 2 courses of degree completion to access the remedy. Co-chair, and I did see the Representative Parker came in.
Thanks for being late.
Johnson, a member of the commission, I want to thank you for the opportunity. I was just recently just having some conversation with Connie Green, whom I've known for a long, long time, and we were talking about the tough economic situation that we're all in, and I want you to keep that in context as you think about House Bill 3356. And I'm here to support 3356 because this bill is designed to provide a remedy for students who are at the cusp of getting their degree but do not have an economic hold on their registration. And I'm going to just move away from this a little bit because I shared with her, Ms. Green, in talking about when we're in economic hard times, and maybe some of us may not remember, but some of us do, how difficult when we started a career path and then we find ourselves in a position or in a place where we can't meet those obligations, and yet we want to. And I think this bill will help us, you know, help them. I think there's no greater achievement that we all seek to have is to have college graduates, those individuals who have completed their course. And so I'm asking you to join me and others who believe that that House Bill 3356 is a remedy that we need to put in place. And I'm sure you're going to hear further testimony that mirrors this. And I want to thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, and members of the committee. My name is Mary Nolan. I have the privilege of representing the 36th District in the Oregon House of Representatives. I am delighted to join my colleague from the Senate in bringing this bill to you. The bill evolved from a concern about completion opportunities or obstacles, actually, that students faced as they approached the completion of their degree, and a dilemma where they might be within, as Senator Winter said, we would actually propose making it 8 credits instead of 6 because credits, at least at the university system, tend to be in 4-credit increments, and so 8 would be 2 classes rather than 6. But as they got very close to completing a degree, having a little hiccup in the system get in the way of completing the degree, putting them in a position where they would have less opportunity available to them to actually make good on the debts that they want to make good on, which would leave the institution holding the debt, someone who wants to pay the debt, but hindered because they are short of a degree and therefore not eligible for jobs that require a degree. They want to acknowledge their obligation. They want to fulfill it. And this bill is brought to you in the spirit of trying to enable that capacity. In the last day or so, we've understood that there have been some questions raised, which is a good thing because you're posting this bill for hearing means that people are thinking, this might actually happen, so we should pay close attention. And the committee should listen to that testimony. We'd be delighted to work with anyone who is who's invested in helping students complete their degree to make the bill serve that objective after you've heard that testimony. You'll also hear from people within the university system about the need for this and the benefit that it brings to programs like The Last Mile that you'll hear a little bit about, but other initiatives to really focus on that last completion for students. I thank you for your time, and I really appreciate your paying attention to this bill.
Thanks to both of you. Are there questions for Representative
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a comment, not a question. You know, first of all, I just want to extend my gratitude to you both for bringing this bill forward. This is a problem that's not just an Oregon problem. It's a national problem. And I first really became aware of it at a conference that WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, had on articulation and college completion. And there are many, many students out there all across the country who, except for, you know, as you put it, a little hiccup in their life, would have college degrees at this point. And we have to figure out a way to bring them back. They, in their mind, the situation is hopeless, and they see no path for themselves. And yet, and this is, you know, this is a common thing, you know, when you're dealing with students or, you know, if you're a parent with children, things that, you know, to them seem like impossible obstacles. But actually, they're just very little things that, you know, we can just do a little and fix the problem and get them on their way. So I see this bill as embodying that spirit.
Thank you. By your leave, Mr. Chair, both the Senator and I are supposed to be in other committees, so we will not stay for the entirety of your hearing, but offer our services to help with amendments.
Not because we don't want to.
Just one question. Is that jade you're wearing around your neck today?
I wish it was, but it wasn't.
Beautiful and perfectly fits the decor today, so yes, my compliments. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay. We have some more folks to call up today from... Here is a difficult name. I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher it, but Sungkwat Chia, and you know who you are. Thank you very much. Come forward, please. Is there someone else with you or by yourself?
Yes, my colleague Robert.
Please come forward. Please tell us who you are and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Dembro. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Sukhwan Jaj. I am a faculty member at Portland State University. I am director of the University Studies program. It's a nationally known program. And I also serve as a special assistant to the Provost for Student Success. In that capacity, I lead the Student Success Initiative and coordinate the various activities that are taking place in the university to increase our retention and graduation rates. I'm here to talk about the Last Mile Committee and some other things that we are learning and to support this bill.
And Co-Chair Johnson and Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Robert Mercer. I'm in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at Portland State with responsibility for a lot of issues related to student success, graduation, academic requirements.
Let me begin by telling you briefly about the Last Mile Committee. This summer, we established a committee with cross-functional membership. The committee is focused on looking at students who file for graduation, did not graduate, and left BSU. These are students who are very, very close to the finish line. We looked at data from 2 years, 2005 to 2007. I think some of the summer sessions were also included in it, and identified from this group about 350 students who had sufficient credits to graduate. Over the past few months, the members of this committee, which includes Bursar, Assistant Director of Financial Aid, it's chaired by my colleague Robert Mercer, the President of our Faculty Senate, and others, have been contacting students and working with them, and we have graduated about 77 students as of yesterday as a result of this effort, which is a very good example of how a focus on something like this works. The committee was assigned $50,000 in a way, which they could have assigned any way they wished to help students navigate any kind of financial hold that was placed on their account, any bills in some ways they owed to the university, and also help them with academic plans. There are a couple of things that we learned in it. I'd like to reinforce this idea that there should be a focus on at least two courses. So if you look at only 6-credit limit, that translates into being short of graduation by only one course. A reasonable place, at least in my opinion, would be 2 courses, very, very close to the finish line. Secondly, the thing that we realized quite clearly, not only here but in our studies on student success, that financial planning is essential at any level of a student's education, but most certainly here. If a student can provide a financial plan on how to pay for this, then how close they are, this should be supported. And that financial planning really goes hand in hand with academic planning. Not only how you will pay for this, but what courses you would take so that you would graduate. So it's not only that you are 6 or 8 credits short, but what courses you will take so you'll meet your degree requirements and so on. In terms of why this is important, once students leave a college, it is incredibly difficult for them to come back to the college. The data suggests that, national studies suggest that. The best time to help them graduate is when they are in that academic context. Departure from college, and in some ways getting them back, requires tremendous effort. So the right place for intervention and building strategies and tactics is at that particular time. I think at this moment I'd like to sort of pass it on to my colleague, Robert Mercer.
Thank you, Sequan. One of the things I would just like to add is, in this group of students that we've been looking at, slightly fewer than half of those students are kept from registering because they have some kind of financial hold. In our case, they owe the university more than $100. And so you can't register for the next term if you have a bill of over $100. That's a huge percentage. And one of the other issues that's important to know is, within the overall group of students who applied to graduate and didn't graduate, underrepresented minority students are overrepresented. If you look at the number of students who had financial holds and couldn't continue, underrepresented minority students are even a larger part of that group than of the students who don't have holds. One of the really interesting things is, we look at these students, and not more than a handful of them had academic difficulty. They don't have lower than average GPAs or anything like that. Other things happened. And as Sequan said, one of the issues that we're discovering in this last mile committee, where we're doing everything humanly possible to reach out to students who've been gone for 2 terms, 3 terms, a year, 2 years, is a week after a student stopped attending campus, their email becomes a dead end. So finding those students, the more time passes, becomes increasingly difficult. And just one of the things I'm grateful for my career at PSU is to have been able to spend a good amount of my time advising students over the years. And the ones that kind of break my heart are the students who dropped out somewhere 20 years ago because they were offered a job, whether it was PSU or whether it was somewhere else. They got offered a job, and they've been doing that job for 20 years or 25 years, and suddenly their company gets sold and they have to go out on the job market. And every comparable job requires a bachelor's degree. So they have 20 years experience, but they were 12 credits away from graduation 20 years ago. And now the way everything changes, they're 40 credits away. And they have kids and a mortgage and all these other kinds of things. And as you say, it just makes it harder and harder to graduate. I'll just say, I know that there will be difficulties in terms of how people, if this bill passes, how to figure out implementation. I think at PSU, we've kind of figured out what the issues are for undergraduates and graduate students and how we would proceed. But sometimes it's important enough to put pressure on people to say, we got to figure this out. And I think the difference this will make for our students and is worth whatever effort we need to put in to get there.
May I just add one more thing, Robert? The way the bill is structured, the way it is operationalized, it focuses on almost sort of an instrumental sort of intervention. You owe some money, then a set of things would happen. But there is another sort of impact that is really positive of this bill. It reduces financial concern. Some of the research that we are doing focuses on both financial concern and financial need. Having between real money and simply being concerned about not being able to pay. This bill addresses financial concerns also, and the impact of financial concern is very clear in terms of student retention and persistence. Being worried about how to pay is incredibly problematic for students when they're making choices about continuing or not. So it addresses financial concerns as well as it addresses this issue of need and being able to actually enroll in courses. So at both of these levels, it works. Thank you so much.
One question. You need to help me understand, I guess, from the beginning. What is it that prevents PSU or any other institution of higher ed from doing this on their own right now? Why can you not contract with these students or work out a payment plan that's amenable to you and to them both?
And I can probably answer that, and I'll say that
I hope so.
As a result of this committee's work and bringing together the people from financial aid and the bursar's office and everything, they have been more than willing to help students figure out a financial plan and, in many cases, to look at debt and try and reduce it based on fees charged for overdue library books or things like that, to try and figure out, okay, what can we reduce to help this student further along? So we can do that individually, and we'll do it wherever we find somebody who needs that help. But for our own students, and I won't speak for everybody else at every other institution, but if we knew there was a system in place that said, we have to do this, and here's how it works for those students. If you find yourself in this situation, here's what you need to do. And it was a well-communicated, well-distributed thing, we'd have more students who took advantage of it. Versus the student who simply, because one of the things we're learning from this process is students got into financial trouble, and we contacted them 2 years later and said, you know, how about if I get you in touch with the bursar's office? And they said, can you do that? Is that possible? Really? They never imagined that they could approach somebody and ask for help.
To answer your question, we are doing this work. We are very motivated to continue to do this work. We are quite successful in it, and we hope that the scale and scope of it changes. But we are also seeing the impact of our actions. Our hope is, at least my hope is, that this bill changes the default setting on a system. In a way, the default setting is not the initiative of a small group of people or the inspired work of a larger group. But how do you, in essence, set up the default setting where this begins to happen? And whatever the timeline, whatever the complexity that might be that one would have to resolve,
that this issue is systemically addressed, not only in terms of need, but also in concern. Robert, the story he told, in my mind, it's about students having financial concerns, not knowing what to do. This forces the system, sort of default setting to, in some ways, change.
We had, this committee had your president here a few weeks ago to talk about your PSU and so forth, gave a great report, but he also talked about how one of the changes that he had brought on board since he'd been at PSU was to deal with the problem of the lack of retention of students. Apparently we had a lot of students that just weren't getting traction and so forth, but put in place a plan to have more counselors to work with students early on to ensure that they were getting into the courses they needed to get to help them navigate. And I guess what I sense a need for is some of this, perhaps at your institution and other institutions of higher ed, to interdict these students earlier on, as you talked about, to ensure that they've got a budget, that they understand the cost, that they have a methodology for paying for that earlier on, rather than waiting till they get to the end of their career. So is that what you're kind of referring to or asking about?
Yes. Just to sort of reinforce what President Vival said, we are leading a student success initiative. I'm coordinating the initiative. It's a portfolio of initiative that includes small projects and large. Last Mile Committee is one of those projects. It is part of this advising initiative. Now the new hires that we have had are involved in it, in contacting students, working them with them quite proactively. We are working on three other things that will help us do this work. Unified advising records, sharing of academic records, degree maps, where students will have a map of how to complete a degree, and data mining of databases to see this, to identify students before they fail out or get themselves in some sort of a position where it's difficult to navigate and finish the degree. So it is a fairly systematic approach in addressing the problem, and Last Mile Committee's work actually fits in with very much with the advising initiative. That's one part of our work.
Thank you. Mr. Springer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. And thank you, gentlemen, and welcome. I guess the first question I have is, and I'm trying to think back of when I had student fees and that kind of thing, and they were always part of the budget, and I hated all of them, quite frankly. But I factored them into my plans. So, and I remember something about not registering for the next term if I had fees, is that correct? Can fees be carried over? Can they accumulate?
Right now, you can't register for the next term if you have a balance owed, whatever it is, of $100 or more.
Okay.
So you can imagine $100 isn't a lot. I mean, in terms
not
of
the
you
fees.
Can accumulate $100 pretty easily now.
Okay, so
may I just add something to this? In reality, in terms of detail, it's somewhat complex. So it depends on a timeline when you're registering. At one stage, it's $500, but as you come closer to the quarter, the limit is set at $100. If you drop a class and try to add, you can't do those kinds
right.
of things. So,
follow up, please.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the students, because you're already doing this, and I think that's great that you're taking extra steps to facilitate that walk down the aisle, if you will. So what is the average amount that you're making these payment plans for so they can receive their degree?
So we've actually set a limit just because we were given $50,000 and we had a huge pool of students that conceivably would need help. So right now, we've set a limit that said we can either apply roughly the cost of a four-credit class. We could roughly pay either $500 towards remaining tuition a student will have to complete their degree, or we can apply $500 towards their outstanding debt. So in the case of a student, say, who owes about $1,000, we would first of all ask our bursar's office to look at what that debt is and to determine whether any of it can be reduced, whether they're late fees or late charges or whatever. Mm-hmm. So can we get that $1,000 down to $750 that way? And if we apply $500, and then we say to the student, okay, set up a payment plan for these $250. So we'd love to have more money than that. We'd love to be able to help students because some of them have pretty significant debt.
Another follow-up, please. Mr. Chair, please.
So once these students set up the payment plan and then receive their degree, do you have many that are defaulting on that?
I think it's too early. We started this summer.
Oh, okay. And I apologize for coming in late. I had another appointment. You probably said that.
We established a committee this summer. We have so far 77, I'm told by Robert, 77 students who have met the degree requirements and would graduate. The target we have set for this committee was 50 students, so they have exceeded it. And looks like they would graduate over 100 students this year.
May I? Would you indulge me one?
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I guess it's not a guess. It is a comment, and I just put this out here, and I'm going to look like the meanie here. First of all, I would never ask you to not do what you're doing. I think you've put a lot of effort into helping people get to success, however that's measured in that degree, and I think that's very important. That said, I remember the years of free room and board, but everything else was on my dime, and I just had to manage well, and sometimes I didn't, and I had some consequences, and I had to manage well. And you talked about financial planning at one piece, and this is a piece of that there. And I don't mean to sound hard-hearted here, but we're talking about individuals that are launching into life here, and embracing all of these responsibilities in a very real way. And I just again, I would never step in and say, don't do what you're doing. I think that's your choice, and you should do that, and I think you're doing an admirable thing. But I think we also just maybe need to keep in the back of our head that responsibility pieces. I'm ready to go have the career, and I'm ready to do these things, and these $200-$300 fines are a piece of managing that. And I just offer that and let the arrows fly because I'm the meanie here.
Could I just...
Sure.
So I can give you my own example as a student who went through public education in Oregon. So, and I think you can use me as an example up till about 20 years ago. I was an undergraduate. I got financial aid. There was a lot more grant money available. So the percentage of financial aid that was grant money versus loans was significantly more than. I think other people will likely add that up to 20 years ago, 2/3 of the cost of a student's education was borne by the state, and 1/3 was the responsibility of the student and the student's family or wherever else they got money. Well, we've completely flipped that percentage now. 2/3 of the burden is on students, and 1/3 comes from state support. I think if we think about the cost of living, I mean, I graduated from college owing $400.
Good for you.
Because I had an apartment that cost $180. That I was talking to a student who lives in that same apartment in Southwest Portland. It's now $900 a month. I completely agree with you, but I think these students are facing burdens we just didn't have.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It's tough. I do not debate that with you whatsoever. It is tough.
So, gentlemen, the university still has a hold over these students, right, after they come back and take their credits. What sort of hold do they have, you know, to make sure that they still pay those past fees?
Well, if that student graduates and owes money, the university won't give them a copy of their diploma. They won't release official transcripts. But having said that, an employer, they can go out and get a job and say they have a degree, and an employer can go to the National Student Clearinghouse and verify, yeah, this person's got a degree. And at PSU, I won't speak for the rest of the institutions because I don't know. If an employer said, we have to have a copy of your diploma before we'll hire you, the university would send directly to the employer basically a Xerox copy of a diploma. So from our perspective, it means you can go out and get a job, but you still have this debt, and we have these few things we're going to hold on to until that's been cleared up.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to follow up, I mean, there are many occupations, you know, my own included, where I did have to produce an official transcript in order to, you know, to begin employment. So, I mean, my point is, I think the university still does have a hold over the student,
yes.
But the student will have completed the education. So then the problem is simply one of finances and paying off that debt. It's the burden of returning to school and, you know, taking a chance on, you know, getting back into studies has been removed. That's a reason that I support this.
Thank you. Thanks, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
We're gonna open up. Rep. Dembro has to go testify on behalf of another bill elsewhere in the building. So we're going to open up a public hearing on a different bill. We'll keep this open because we still have people to talk to that. So I ask everybody to kind of compartmentalize your mental processes here for a bit. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3521. And Representative Dembro is going to present to us.
Oh, better not.
Thought so.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, honorable colleagues. I'm Michael Dembro, State Representative, House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose, from the heights of Rocky Butte to the city within a city of Maywood Park. It's a real pleasure for me to talk to you about House Bill 3521, which in many ways is really related to the conversation that we're having now about college completion, trying to find those cracks that students fall through and seal them over, or do our best to seal them over. House Bill 3521 returns us to a subject that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which is the subject of articulation and transfer. A couple of weeks ago, we heard a bill from Representative Wisnant, House Bill 3866, which essentially charged the Joint Boards of Education to work on transfer and articulation. This does a very similar thing, and in fact, Representative Wisnant and I are the co-chief sponsors of this bill. And it sort of takes it a step further. Let me just back up and give you the history of how this came about. I mentioned a few minutes ago a conference that Witchie had on college completion and articulation, and it was there that I first saw a statistic from NCHEMS on the number of people out there who have some college but who don't have a degree. And in fact, the number of people who perhaps have enough credits to get a degree, but don't have a degree. And I'm thinking particularly of those students who started at a community college and accumulated enough credits to get an associate's or close to. They decided to transfer. I mean, their plan had always been to get a bachelor's degree. So they transferred to a four-year school, being confident that within a couple of years they would have that bachelor's degree. And then life happened, and that couple of years became 3 years, became 4 years, became 5 years. They had no bachelor's degree. They, by that point, had plenty of credits to get an associate's degree, but they didn't have that. And I thought about that and thought about, you know, as we're looking at 40-40-20 and the number of students that were trying to get into that middle 40 of having an associate's degree, the number of people in the state who probably are there, I mean, they have enough credits to get an associate's degree, but there's a kind of bureaucratic obstacle that's keeping that from happening. And so what could we do to make it easier for them to more or less automatically get their associate's degree once they've reached that threshold of having enough credits either from the original institution or a combination of the original plus credits wrapped back from the transfer school in the appropriate areas. The easier we could make that, the more automatic we could make that, the quicker we could get people to having an associate's degree and, you know, thereby, you know, having access to a better job, self-esteem, you know, all the good things that degrees produce. So, you know, with that in mind, I requested the drafting of what came to be called House Bill 3521. In the meantime, I was approached by the Oregon Community College Association, which had also been thinking, they've been thinking along similar lines. A number of states, let me back up and say that WICHE has recently produced a document which has been put on the shared drive. It's called Best Practices for Statewide Transfer Articulation Programs. Yeah, and you have a summary of it there. And one of the things that they recommend as a best practice is that states come up with, you know, a document that is a kind of transfer student bill of rights. And we talked about that and decided, you know, why don't we take this bill and take the impulse behind Representative Wisnant's original bill and expand it so that Oregon could itself come up with its own Oregon Transfer Student Bill of Rights, so that students in high school or outside of high school, you know, who are considering higher education, could know with confidence that they could go, that they could start their education at an Oregon Community College, transfer perhaps to another community college or to a four-year school, and not lose credits, not lose money, not fall through the cracks. And that in a nutshell, is what House Bill 3521 is all about. We have some people who are prepared to speak to it, and the first person who's going to speak, Connie Green, has been doing a lot of work in this area and can take us back to some of the earlier work that was authorized in Senate Bill 342, which Senator Schrader developed back in the 2005 session, and then bring us up to today and give us some recommendations of what the best path would be to create an Oregon Transfer Student Bill of Rights. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if you want to hear from the witnesses. Connie has to be out of here in about 10 minutes. So
are there any questions for Representative Dembro? If not, I'll call up Connie Green at this time.
Great. And I got a text. I don't have to leave the committee, so I'll be here if you have any questions. Or I'll ask myself some questions.
You start answering, that's worrisome.
When he starts arguing with himself, yeah, then it's really a problem.
For the record, I'm Connie Green. I'm Vice President at Chemung Bay Community College, but I've had the pleasure to work with the Oregon University System, Office of Community Colleges, over the past 5 years doing policy work around our joint work. So it has been a joy. And many of them are behind me, and I think we were here before in Wisnesville kind of giving you some history. One of the things we do well in Oregon, and Senate Bill 342 is a great example, is you as a legislature said, here's some outcomes. We want apply baccalaureates, advanced placement, international baccalaureate. We want some things aligned, dual credit. You didn't tell us how. You said we want it aligned, and you gave us some time. So we worked together, and when you work together, if you think of our 7 universities, they're very different, and our 17 community colleges are very different. But the 24 together, the public sector post-secondary, is willing to do this work. But we need to have time to work with people who are actually faculty members. Nothing against Representative Dembro, Co-Chair Dembro, but when you're a faculty member and you're invested in this curriculum, how do we get you from PCC, Portland State, University of Oregon, Tillamook Bay, all talking together when you want to change something. It helps if you can have the buy-in and their views. So Senate Bill 342 left us do that on a lot of issues. And we've come a long way. Your joint boards and subcommittee of it, the Unified Education Enterprise, has done that work, brought people together. So when we started looking at the next set of work, we've done a lot of alignment work from high school to community colleges to universities. And there's some great work that the people behind me will talk to you about of how we're beginning to share a shared warehouse of data so we can actually do better tracking, better information sharing of our students, and how do we actually help in more productive ways. So there's a lot of great things going on. Most likely the most difficult area for us in the next part of this is actually how do we get better with articulation and transfer. We have a lot of articulation agreements. I think I mentioned that the last time I was here. So every community college has a list of articulation agreements. So if I have a major, it is articulated to Oregon State one way, because that's how they see it. I articulate the same major in business to Portland State another way, because that's how they see it. And I articulate it differently to Western Oregon, because that's how they see it. So we articulate them back and forth. They can be the same major, but there's the nuances between. If I assume that six of you up there were a different university, you might ask for one course. You might have two electives. You might have a core gen ed that's a little bit bigger. You might choose to have an internship that's required in the degree. Someone else. So it's different. Make sense? So when you do the articulations, they look different. So how do you begin to bring that together for students? Because if I take my son-in-law, he was a student at Chemeketa. He's going to get an associate's degree from Chemeketa in business. Was working full-time, met my daughter, they got married, that's been wonderful. But in the process, he realized, I don't know if I have time to complete the rest of the business degree. But in looking at it, he had two classes he could get an associate of general science. So he went ahead and got that degree. When you choose to change those degrees, it makes a difference. And then where does that degree go, and how does that one person count it? So there's lots of complexities. So the reason I think that we've talked about a student bill of rights, and Representative Dembro, I guess on the shared drive, the study from WICHE, it looked at all states and said, what's the best practice in transfer? Where do you go? How do you get articulation? How do you help students not get caught in repeating classes? How do you have them not get caught having to say, oh, that doesn't count anymore because you're going to this institution? The first step of that is a student bill of transfer. Here's the core things. And so our thinking was, if there was a way, legislatively, like you did with Senate Bill 340, to say, we'll either go out and copy. Colorado has one. Texas has one. California has one. They're out there. Copy one. Adapt one. But make sure you have one. And then build your systems. As we share our data, build your systems. Look at the templates out there you could do differently. But together create something better for Oregon students. We have a lot of things that work well. We have a Joint Boards Articulation Committee. It does a lot of work on this. We have a shared Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer. But the real final piece is truly how do we make it easier? Now we do heavy work together. How do you make it easier to do the statewide articulation and transfer? We've got all the pieces. We've got to get better at it. If you could have this bill, the bill's coming together, help us say, go complete the student bill of rights. Or if you want to look at the executive summary, it says that some other things you should do as well. Student bill of rights. Make sure you share your data. Those are the kinds of things that we can then figure out how to do it, because we have to work with 24 systems and 24 sets of faculty to make it work. But we've done it before, and we can do it again.
Is that a quizzical look or a question, Rep. Parker?
It's both. I'm not sure where the question should be directed. I'll throw it out here, recognizing that maybe it should be answered by you or more than you.
Okay.
What I'm wondering is, and this may be addressed in here, I don't know. I haven't read it. When a student graduates from an institution after having been in one to many other institutions previously, the degree is granted by the graduating final institution. Is that correct? I assume so. How do we then recognize and accommodate the differences in instruction and instructors that exist at across all of these institutions. Do we accept that the standards that are being implemented are sufficient and adequate to guarantee that a student coming out of all of these classes has the basic level of education in these things? Yes.
So, Representative Hocker, I think part of it is all of us are accredited, and part of the accreditation is making sure that you have both quality and proficiency in your classes. The other part of it is there are certain classes that we share a lot of. So you want to take beginning classes, writing 121. Mm. We work really hard at consistent outcomes in those classes. I believe the question you raise would be the question that faculty from all 24 would raise and say, well, but I teach mine my way, and you teach yours your way, and I'm sure my way is better. That is usually where we begin the conversation with faculty. Where we end the conversation with faculty consistently is, what is it really about, and how do we get there together? So I look at how we came. We actually agreed in the state of Oregon to, at the end of 2 years, we have a set of outcomes that we've agreed to. Here's what you should have in any classes you take when you get done at the end of 2 years. Here's a set of outcomes that students should be able to do. And we agreed to that from 24 institutions. So I think it can be done. You raise the question of why it might take time, because we have to start with why mine is different than yours. Anatomy and physiology, we all teach because of our health fields. We taught it a lot of different ways. 5 years ago, we came together and we agreed to anatomy and physiology. It got consistent. We would accept each other's courses consistently. Not only was the title consistent, but the outcomes were consistent. So if you give us a little bit of time, get the faculty in the room, we can really do that well. But you're right. We always begin with the question you raised. But I think I've seen us consistently get to a really powerful answer for student learning.
Maybe I could just address that too, Rep. Parker. You know, we've had a system of transfer in this country for many years. I mean, students from other states transfer their credits in here. And it's, you know, kind of part of the accreditation process that, you know, the accreditors come into each institution and make a determination that the work is of a comparable level. Now, that may not be true exactly. You know, in some states, courses are delivered on a quarter format, others a semester. So, I mean, there's some tweaking that has to happen, but that is a kind of basic assumption that underlies the academic world.
Understood, and thank you. With all the caveats, right and wrongs of the rating system, there are institutions that from which a degree carries different weight than from other institutions, mm-hmm. right? And I'm just wondering about how those institutions view granting degrees to people who have spent perhaps half of their or a quarter of their training time at other institutions. Sure. And I'm sure it's been discussed a fair amount, and I understand and appreciate your comments about dealing with the faculty, and I'm sure others at the campuses, and we don't have to address all of this right here, right now, but it's something I'm really curious about.
Okay, if I could just add one other point. You know, last summer I got to go to the PSU graduation, and I was really struck there by, if I'm not mistaken, and I know Laura's in the room, you may know, maybe half the students who were graduating had actually started somewhere else. Anyway, I'm not sure what the exact proportion is, but a very large number of graduates from our OUS system actually started at a community college. As I understand it, performed as well or better than those who began at the university. So this is something that, you know, I think is is part of our world now. Actually, it's quite rare, in fact, for students to graduate with all of their credits coming from that institution. So many of them are multiply enrolled, either through distance learning or through transfer, simultaneously enrolled. And that, for me, is what needs to be an important part of this articulation system that we come up with, a recognition that we have these students who are swirling in and out of multiple institutions, but somehow making it all work.
Representative Harker, Representative Dembro, Bob Kiernan is behind me here, and I'd love to have Bob speak to this, because more of their students are coming from community colleges, more are the ones who get their bachelor's degree from community colleges. We've been doing a lot of work of looking how they do, and they do, they complete at the rate equal to or better than, right, Bob? Okay, I thought that was it. Then the ones who begin at the universities, we also see so much of the students going back and forth. And so even with our dual credit programs, we're tracking how they do, and they do extremely well. So I think we are tackling it. We're trying really hard to monitor that and help encourage that success. And there is a difference in degrees, you know. I'm sure from all 24 of us, there's a difference of pride in what is there. But I think what is consistently happening in Oregon is people are trying to say there is some consistency, there is quality, and our degrees will take you, it's an associate degree or bachelor's degree, will take you to the place where you want to go next. And once you get that first job, are our students being successful? And I think in Oregon, our students, no matter where the degree come from, are being successful. And you will hear that testimony over and over from community colleges and universities. We are proud of our education system.
Thank you for your comments. And if you need to go,
I'll let you
get going. Thank you, Connie. Let's go ahead and bring up those other folks that Connie was referring to. Carissa Caldwell, Bob Kiernan, and Joe Holliday from OUS. Chris is from the community college or workforce development. We'll go ahead and stay on this track or this thought pattern, guys, just so we don't get too convoluted. So we're still addressing House Bill 3521.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I'm Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives in the Oregon University System. It's a pleasure to be back here again today. And with House Bill 3521, to save your time, I'll just echo what Connie Green said. We are very much in agreement with Connie in the Oregon University System and the Chancellor's Office that we'd like to have your guidance on how to proceed on a Student Bill of Rights. We obviously believe in that concept. And as we did with the Associate of Arts transfer degree and our statewide consensus between the joint boards and the 24 schools on lower division general education requirements, we feel we can do a very thorough job of that moving forward. So that's really all I intended to say there. I did have a brief answer, unsolicited answer, I suppose, to Representative Harker's question, which is that there is a thorough transfer evaluation that occurs at every university when a student transfers in to determine course equivalencies. And so that is a very rigorous process. And as Co-Chair Dembro mentioned, it's very much part of an accreditation process. So.
Representative Johnson and members of the committee, my name is Carissa Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And in conversations with Representative Dembro, he asked that we talk a little bit about the longitudinal data system that we're building. Last July, we received a state longitudinal data system 3-year, $10.4 million grant from the U.S. Department of Ed. It came into the Department of Ed in Oregon, and the other partners are university system, community colleges and workforce development, the employment department, and the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And Bob's going to talk more about the specifics, but what we're looking at, by combining the data from Department of Ed, community colleges and workforce development, and the university system, Oregon will be able to examine student progress and outcomes better.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Kieran, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Institutional Research and Planning for the Oregon University System. Most people don't know what institutional research is, so what we do basically is collect a lot of unit record data on our students, the demographics, the courses they're taking, and do reports and analysis on that. So some people would consider me a data wonk. In terms of the statewide longitudinal data system, the grant was awarded for a 3-year period to combine the records from students in K through 12, community college, and OUS so that we would be able to have a single source location for the entire study of students as they go through our systems. It's a very valuable research tool. It'll take us at least that 3 years to put it together. And the primary mission, as described in the grant, is a research data warehouse. The principles behind it are to combine the records by using personal identifiers so that we can take high school graduates and their records and then track them into community colleges or Oregon University System places. There's some other components of the grant that are going on that are linked to teacher standards and practices where we're going to try and find best practices and identify where those are happening and move forward on that. But in terms of the longitudinal data system and its usefulness, I need to make a differentiation between a data warehouse, which is what we're building, and a transactional data system, which is what you might see a transcript derived from. So if you're going to transfer from one institution to another, you'll send a copy of the transcript from that institution to another. That's a transactional system that is up to date and current. The statewide longitudinal data system that we're building is snapshot data at the post-secondary level. So it will not have all of the up-to-date data that we need. So although we can link data together for a single student, we wouldn't pretend to be able to produce an actual official transcript of that. And what happens when we collect data in a snapshot fashion? We'll, for example, get some grades that will be incomplete. We'll never update that in a data warehouse, but that will become updated in a transactional system. So we wouldn't put forward that the data that's in this data warehouse can be used for transactional operations. And in fact, the plan is to put the data together, matching on identifiers, and then remove the identifiers from the database so that within the database you can't even identify individual students. That allows us to open up the research database to faculty members, to people who might not pass scrutiny for having rights to the private data. FERPA, the Family Educational Right to Privacy Act, has a great deal to do with how we do business in that way. So by creating a research database, we don't address any FERPA. We're FERPA compliant. If there's any questions on what we're doing and how it might help, I'd be happy to respond.
Question for our panel? Representative Ambrose.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So you understand what our goal is here. You know, we want to make it easier to inventory where students are so that if, for example, you know, they were to reach the associate's level, they could be notified that, you know, you have plenty of credits. It's time for you to take advantage of that. Do you see any avenue for us being able to do that, particularly when people are co-enrolled at multiple institutions?
There are, Mr. Chair and Representative Dimbro, there are some possibilities of how to do that. One of the things that FERPA specifies is that the student has control over their records, and they must initiate a request in order for a transcript to be sent. Now, I want to sort of include here a caveat that I seek legal advice whenever I'm in any gray area. I hope you don't take what I'm saying here as legal advice of any kind, and it gets more complicated every day. Robert Mercer alluded to the National Student Clearinghouse data, and the community colleges have access to the National Student Clearinghouse data. They won't
give all the information that you need, but it's possible, and this is just me thinking out loud essentially here about how you might solve some of the problems and still comply with the regulations, the federal regulations we're obligated to. They can find out if a student has gone to another institution and whether they were part-time or full-time, and they can get a record back for every term that student signs up at an institution. Not quite all institutions are represented in the National Student Clearinghouse, but they claim 91% of all post-secondary enrollments are in there. If that were the case, and they found a student with a match, they could then determine if that student had requested privacy, and students in all public institutions, and in fact all institutions that get financial aid, federal financial aid, have the right to request privacy. And if they request privacy, then we are not allowed to say anything about that. But if they haven't, and most students don't, then the community colleges may be able to track through the National Student Clearinghouse approximately how many units a student would get. Then they could contact the student if they were in the directory for that institution, that is, if they hadn't requested privacy, and then contact the student and prod them to request a transcript be sent and the credits articulated and a degree awarded. That's just me thinking out loud.
Thank you, Rick.
That is a complicated process.
It can be, and FERPA gets interpreted
differently. Laws enacted in other agencies. Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions for our panelists here? We have one more person to testify on behalf of this. Thank you. Andrea Henderson, would you please come forward? I swear to God.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Oregon Community College Association, representing the 17 colleges in Oregon. Testifying in support of this bill today, this is a concept that my board members are extremely interested in. They've had extensive conversations about students and student needs and would like to have additional efforts and work done to improve for our students certainty around transfer and articulation so that as students move through the system, either in between community colleges or from community colleges to universities, there is a greater sense for students in terms of what they can expect and what their outcomes will be. The we did some work also looking at the WICHE report and also in conversations with my board, and really came up with some very specific support around the idea of a student transfer bill of rights. We think it's very important for our students and would really encourage work on this issue. The bill as it currently is drafted, we would like to see a few changes in it. Essentially, as you've seen from your previous panelists, actually making this work is very difficult. It's difficult work that needs to be done. There are systems that need to be changed to actually make it happen. And so what we would encourage from the committee is give the direction to have this happen, but at this point, not to put too much into statute that tells us exactly how to do it, so that there's ample opportunity and time for the colleges and the universities in the state to work together collaboratively, as they have in the past, to move this concept forward. Frankly, at this point, we don't know what all the statutory requirements would need to be. Some of that work still needs to be done so that we can then come back next session and in future sessions to continue to look at this issue. This is what needs to be in statute. Here's what we've already done. But to really set out a direction that we do need to have a student transfer bill of rights and essentially hope the legislature will pass legislation setting that out as a goal, and the colleges will work to get there. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
1966. The 1966 is really...
It is very similar.
Yeah, so I would just open 2866 and let them speak to both. I mean, it's the notion of articulation they want to speak about.
Okay. So we've been talking about House Bill 3356. We will close that. Well, we could leave it open for right now. Let's just do this. We have another bill that we heard previously, which is House Bill 2866, that deals with very similarly with the same topic. And we have some people here who would like to add some more testimony onto the record for that today. So I'm going to go ahead and open up public hearing on House Bill 2866. And Keenan Weir, I believe, and Catherine Lundquist. Both from the student associations. So, committee, again, I just want to, these bills are very similar in nature. So, as we listen, maybe want to try to pick out the nuances about where the limitations are, where they're similar, overlaps, that kind of thing, as we go forward from here. So, please tell us who you are and tell us what's on your mind.
Thank you. Co-Chair Johnson and Deborah, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Keenan Weir, and I'm a student at Lane Community College. And I also sit on the board of directors for the Oregon Student Association. The Oregon Student Association represents over 100,000 Oregon students in public universities and community colleges around the state. We advocate for an affordable and accessible post-secondary education system for all Oregonians. And it is the central mission of OSA that has brought me here today to speak to you on House Bill 2866. As a student intending to transfer to an OUS institution, this bill affects me and so many others in my situation. After I complete my AAOT degree at Lane, I am planning on transferring to Portland State University to pursue a bachelor's degree in political science. This process is difficult for many reasons, and I believe that the intent of House Bill 2866 will help alleviate some of those issues that community college students face when looking to transfer to a four-year university. 51.1%, this is from 2008 and 2009, 51% of full-time equivalent students at LCC are in lower division or were in lower division collegiate courses, which in other words are classes that can be used while transferring to receive a bachelor's degree at a four-year institution. So this accounts for nearly 8,000 students at LCC, and statewide that number is closer to 50,000 students, many with plans to attend a four-year college in Oregon. So I would like to express my support for the framework of this bill. A statewide transfer system is of the utmost importance to serve not only the diverse population of students in the community college sector, but also to allow for a diverse body of options for those students later in their post-secondary career. I believe we heard in the informational session for this bill a number of weeks ago that House Bill 2866 is the vital step, or the vital next step, in ensuring that ensuring a smooth transition between institutions. And I appreciate the groundwork that our institutions have laid out, but now it's time to move forward. We must assist students in making well-informed life decisions that could save some students thousands of dollars. Ensuring that general education courses at two-year and four-year schools are accepted throughout the state is important to students who are unsure of their transfer destination. This should create a process allowing for variability of attending to attend any post-secondary school after completion at a two-year institution, as long as the student meets enrollment standards. I also think that it's important that the process is as uniform as possible, meaning that the system to transfer from PCC to PSU is the same as transferring from LCC to the U of O. Not only does this create a clearly understood system of expectations for students and institutions, but it allows for more flexibility to transfer around the state. And as a student I know at LCC, is currently debating whether between transferring to the University of Oregon and Willamette University. Unfortunately, he is finding it difficult to reference those schools' websites and catalogs for information on what classes and credits will be accepted for different programs at those schools. So for many students, this process prevents them from fully strategizing and maximizing their post-secondary experience and leads to overspending on classes in some cases. And so I also want to commend any future effort to create a more tangible online system, such as the increased use of Atlas, or a similar program. To give students a quick picture of those course equivalencies for their degree programs anywhere in the state in one central location. This gives students resources without committing precious staff time and saves students time and grief. Any self-advising tools available for community college students will be helpful, especially at LCC, where lines for student services can be more than 3 hours long. It's very difficult if I were to try and see my counselor to talk about, you know, getting advisement for transferring. It's usually they're only in the office for about 2 hours a day. There's about six people waiting to see them. It's very difficult. So I sympathize with students struggling to make these difficult decisions while also worrying about how they're going to pay to make those decisions. I understand these issues because I am faced with that exact problem every term. It is difficult to be unaware of how a class I am taking now will look when I try to transfer it towards my degree at PSU. The process is not tangible and it needs to be improved. I think this bill starts the process of better defining those things, and before we ask ourselves whether this bill should pass, I would rather pose the question, why don't we have this or a similar system already? So I would like to thank the co-chairs and the rest of the committee for their time and the opportunity to speak on this topic. The passage of this bill would bring a better system in which students can better plan for their future and therefore support our future as a state. So I would encourage you to please vote yes on House Bill 2866. Thank you.
Keenan, I thank you for your testimony. I guess I'm wired a little more practically minded than some folks, and it's easier for me to contemplate a solution if I can have concrete examples of problems. And you guys obviously are you're on the battlefield, if you will, rather than some of the more policy wonk oriented folks who gave us wonderful testimony. But it's easier for me to contemplate what really is going on to hear from folks like you. So I thank you for some of the examples you gave. And Catherine, why don't you share with us what you have, please?
Good afternoon.
Other questions? We can ask when they're finished. But go ahead.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Johnson, Dembro, and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Lindquist, and I'm a second-year student at Mount Hood Community College. I'm a born and raised Oregonian. I grew up in Northeast Portland in the Park Rose District, and I'm here to urge you to support House Bill 2866. I'm currently enrolled in two separate programs at Mount Hood. I plan on graduating with an Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer degree with an emphasis in modern language, as well as an Associate of Applied Science and Medical Office Management. For both degrees, I'm planning on continuing my education at a four-year university. While I'd rather get right back into the workforce after I leave Mount Hood, I know that to be a competitive and sought-after employee, I have to continue my education at a four-year university. Pursuing two degrees means I'll end up taking more classes even before I transfer to university. More classes means I'll be enrolled longer and pay more tuition and fees. I'm only able to attend college through grants and loans and simply can't afford to take classes that don't directly apply to my degree or that won't transfer to a university I end up choosing. Unfortunately, I've already taken classes that don't apply to my degrees, totaling about $2,000 due to the confusion with the current transfer process and how credits for classes will be accepted at other universities. Each term, I speak with about four advisors and faculty members to try and get a better understanding of what classes I need to take and what will transfer over. It's a difficult process, and it also takes a large amount of time that most students have. I am very active in student government, and I'm also a full-time student. I usually take about 19 credits a term, so my time is extremely valuable. If any other courses I have taken do not transfer towards my degree or overlap with other courses I take, then I will literally be wasting hundreds of thousands of dollars. For example, even if five classes that I'm taking are unable to transfer to university, I'll be out of a term of tuition and fees, and that totals about $1,300. Additionally, that would extend the number of courses and terms I'd have to be enrolled in a university, and not only would this result in me taking on more debt, but would delay my entry into the workforce even further. While at Mount Hood, I need to be able to maximize my tuition dollars and time, and we need to improve the transfer system to guarantee the credits students earn will be accepted at universities. I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I strongly urge support on House Bill 2866.
Thank you very much. Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment to you, Catherine, and maybe you're doing the same thing, Keenan, and just didn't mention it. Just kudos to you. 19 credits is tough. I did that in college because I had it figured out. I'm paying the same amount for this amount, so I'm going to go to the top and spend less money and be in there less terms. The price tag for that is you have to work really hard. So kudos to you for that planning. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for coming. I just wanted to clarify for you that the two bills, 2838-66 and 2866 and 3521, are at some point going to be brought together. So you can expect we're going to have some bill on creating a transfer bill of rights. It may be one number, it may be the other, so the key thing here is just the concept of making transfer more efficient, more effective, allowing you to be more successful.
Yes. Okay, thanks you guys, appreciate you being here.
Thank you
very much. Anybody else would care to talk to House Bill 2866 here today? Seeing none, we will go ahead then and well, we can close our hearings on those two bills, correct?
We can close the public hearing on 2866.
I'll close the public hearing on 2866 and 3521, and we are still then have an open hearing on House Bill 3356, and we need to hear from Joe Johnson and John Wyckoff, I believe.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director of the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. With me today is our senior policy advisor, Joe Johnson, who is also a retired community college president from Clackamas Community College, among other places, who will be giving the bulk of our testimony today. I wanted to just touch on a couple of points. First, I'd like to thank both Representative Nolan and Senator Winters for both bringing attention to this issue, which is a legitimate academic barrier that I think we all recognize. That in the last, in the work that PSU has done, in that last mile of college, that financial barriers can be a real impediment to students finishing and getting that degree or certificate that they need. But I'd also like to thank them for their willingness to be understanding that, in our case, the 17 colleges have different financial systems, different approaches to dealing with this, and that our concern with the legislation as it currently stands is more in sort of prescribing a one-size-fits-all approach to it. But we've heard from the sponsors that they have a real willingness to finding a way to bring light to this issue in a way that will work for the colleges and universities who would be implementing it. And so I think we feel like we'll be able to move forward productively and find a way to make progress on this issue. But we would have some concerns about implementing the legislation in its current form that Joe is going to kind of talk to you about.
Joe, might I mention, it looks to me like you must have bumped into Frank Toda somewhere along the line. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Very much so. Very much so. Representative Johnson and members of the committee, I want to mention my background because it reinforces a point made by Representative Denbrough at the beginning of the hearing on this. I had a chance to be a president of Clark College for 14 years in the state of Washington. I was a chancellor in California for 4 years and then a president here for 6 years. And Representative Denbrough is very correct in saying this is an issue that cuts across state boundaries. It's a national issue and it's a problem, and we don't want to minimize that. So we're here in the spirit of trying to work towards this, and then we'll mention three problems that we have with it, and I'm sure those will be addressed as we move forward. First of all, one is, and will make you smile, is simply the issue of computer systems. We all have computer systems. We have them in student record systems, and we have them in financial aid and in the finance business, and they don't necessarily talk to one another, and they're not necessarily standardized among 17 institutions. So it's pretty difficult to have a standardized system in terms of an outcome, because our financial system knows that you haven't made a payment, but it doesn't know how many units you've taken. So there are issues, technical issues, that would need to be addressed. Secondly, we can't quite determine if a student's within 6 units of graduation, and it's probably somewhat unique to community college students. We have the university students who's ready to graduate with a 4-year degree, and they come to us for 1 to 4 classes that they may have needed, and we're not quite aware that they're ready to graduate from the university. And they're on our campus taking these 1 to 4 classes, and that'll initiate their graduation at the university level, so we haven't quite identified them as having a need. And then we have students who are within 1 or 2 courses of graduation who choose not to graduate, and it may have to do with their financial aid, or it may have to do with the idea they're going to explore some more and go on or live at home, whatever the case may be. So even though the system might say something, they may not quite be ready. And then finally, we simply don't know in many instances which degree students are going for, even though they may have indicated beforehand, and that simply has to do with the fact that we have an Associate of Arts Transfer Degree, AAOT, an Associate of Science Degree, ASOT, an Associate of General Studies Degree, AGS, an Associate of Applied Science, AAS, and Associate of General Studies. And it's possible for a student to work out an individual plan at the beginning and not continue along that plan, and it's very difficult for us to tell if a student's on track. In order to comply with this legislation, we literally need students to come in quarterly and reevaluate whether or not they're going on track and whether or not they're going towards graduation, which is really kind of an impossible job. And I'll give an example. In my own household, my son is going to a community college. Portland Community College has had an incredibly positive experience from day one. Has been counseled, has done everything right, and he called his mother. He didn't call me. He called his mother up, and he said, "I think I really want to do an applied engineering thing." He's been a business major all along. Well, I heard that on the phone, and I had a heart attack, and I said, "He's going to go in and see a counselor." And so then he's going to go see a counselor at OIT who talked about the fact that he needs to do a individual transfer planning agreement, which is separate and apart from everything he's been doing. And the simple point is our students are in and out the door. They don't necessarily record their credits with us. So there's some technical issues, but we're certainly willing to work because we agree with you. The more we can help students to graduate with a degree, and we're working towards that, the better off we all are.
And if I could just add one more example, I mean, one of the issues that we've all talked about is where we won't necessarily know that a student, we don't know that a student is close to graduation until they actually come and ask for the degree audit. And so to have to know that ahead of time, because they had an academic hold based on a financial issue, we just, again, wouldn't know until they come and do the audit. So that's one of the conversations that we've been having with the bill sponsors about one of the few areas where we would need a different approach so that we wouldn't have to be doing, sort of as you were saying, sort of quarterly audits to find out where all of our students are.
Reverend Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up, so you would be okay if it were crafted such that the student came to you and said, you know, "I'm close to finishing. I've got this hold on my, enrollment. Can you remove it so that I can finish up?"
Chair Johnson, Representative Denbrough, it would help to address one of the technical concerns that we have at the moment. It's not the only one. I can't come out and say we'd be there at that point. We still have a few other issues that I think we'll be able to work through. I mean, one, for example, is that not all of our colleges currently are in a position, we have colleges of very different sizes to offer payment plans. And so we'd actually have to develop and maybe go through another provider to do that. So we'd actually have to, under the current language that we have, would have to develop a system under which they could do payment plans and things like that. So there's some other technical issues that we would still need to work through and have some, I think, flexibility for different approaches to this to all get to the same goal.
And obviously there is some complicated factors involved. We have 24 institutions, and trying to get everybody to
be able to be on the same playing field, share the same objectives, and working towards the same common purposes. It's, you guys do it on some issues, but right. It may take a little additional collaboration to get this one ready for primetime yet. So, well, I appreciate your testimony. We do have Joe Holliday here also from OUS who would like to speak on this, I believe.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Joe Holliday, Oregon University System. Just wanted to bring you some street level concerns from our registrars and enrollment managers on this bill, were it to become law. And some of it you've heard from the other testimony, but number one, it would work better in OUS if this bill only applied to students who had applied to graduate. We actually have a system where a student identifies that they wish to graduate that year, and that narrows the pool of students that would need to be tracked. So that's number one, apply to graduate. Number two, and Representative Dembrough, this was something you alluded to a minute ago, to require the student to do something, to document that they are ready to graduate. For example, a degree audit or something from their academic advisor. It gets a little complicated. Only the advisor knows if the student's ready to graduate in their major. Only the registrar knows if they're about to graduate with meeting university requirements. So that's number two. And number three, they would like more time. I guess that's the standard response you get from us, but they would like more time to implement this type of a bill, perhaps another year. And if I may also just, Co-Chair Johnson, in response to a question you asked earlier about whether universities wouldn't currently be able to set up these payment plans, and indeed all seven OUS schools do set up payment plans with students on a case-by-case basis. In fact, when we were doing the fiscal impact statement for this bill, we got some examples, and one example we got, I'll share briefly, from Oregon State University. They had over 2,000 students apply to graduate this year. As spring term rolled around, there were about 200 students who were not being allowed to register for financial reasons. As soon as the students were notified, 95% of them, 190 of those students came forward immediately and either paid or set up a payment plan. So that left 11 students. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for a way to work with a smaller group of students that indeed would qualify for this benefit. And I had planned to talk about the last mile committee for PSU even better. They came themselves to talk about it. We're so excited about this idea that Robert and Sue Quant are actually going to come to our chief enrollment officers meeting in April to talk about system-wide applications of the last mile committee idea.
Joe, could you talk about, if you know, what a typical payment plan might look like if in fact the students set upon a payment plan? Is there kind of a standard term of in the length of the payment plan, or is that completely negotiable based on the needs of the students? Can you just tell me as many specifics as I guess you could?
All right. Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I would need to get back to you on that, but I do believe it's very much case by case. It is very individualized. We probably could come up with average payments, but it's something that's broken down and they try to make it more manageable for students, but we can certainly get back to you on that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Any other questions about this? Okay, well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Well, anybody else here would like to talk through this bill, House Bill 3356 today? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close our public hearing. And with that, anything else for the good of the order for the committee today? Rep. Parker?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really like this committee. I really like the things we wrestle with and the thinking and discussion that goes on here. I want to encourage us to continue to aim high. I want to do everything we can to enable the people in this state who want as much education as they can to be able to get it in as affordable and accessible a way as we can enable them to have. In the end, I think what is important for those people is what they take away in their heads, the education that they have. And it's not so much the diploma from one institution or another. It's what they have learned and what they have mastered that's going to enable them to compete effectively or not with their peers in this state and other states and other countries. So let's carry on.
Well said.
Go Vikes.
And I do think it speaks, you know, volumes, I think, the fact that we do, in fact, have a subcommittee on higher ed, you know, this session. And as we've learned, I think our state has paid all too little attention to our higher ed system in this state for far too long. So we will see what we can accomplish together. So thank you very much. See you guys next week. This hearing's adjourned.
Who do I have to thank?